Hello, everybody. This is Jake Senzano, the host of Jake and Gino Podcast, here with my co-host, the multifamily mentor, the coach, chef, the father, six, the best-selling author, the G-Daddy, Gino Barber. Gino, how's it going?
Jake, I'm doing good. What's on your face? What happened to your face today, brother?
So, it's hard to tell, but I got a little scratch right there. I'm a girly man. No, I was out cutting some trees this weekend. We had crazy storms come through, and one of them snapped back and hit me in the face. And then I cut the shit out of that tree. I said, "You don't disrespect me like that, son." And I obliterated. That's what happened, Gino. All right?
No goggles, brother? You weren't in the goggles, huh?
No, I had like my Terminator glasses on. It was great. All right. So, hey, we're back to seriousness. We got a very special episode today because we have one of our upcoming Multifamily Mastery 6 speakers in the house. Okay? He was a former police officer. We don't cancel the police around here. He is the host of the Bigger Pockets Real Estate Podcast, and he's also passionate about helping others build wealth through real estate. So without further ado, David Green, welcome to the show.
Evening, gentlemen. Glad to be here.
Evening? Afternoon? Well, where are you at?
I don't know what time it is for you guys. Are on the East Coast, right?
Yeah, it's like lunchtime. I haven't got my sandwich yet. Yeah. So we're still here. But so we were talking about Instagram before the show. I was just surfing the gram looking for my dopamine hits, and I heard Dan Bilzerian say that once he becomes a billionaire, he's going to take a reset. He's going to work as a Walmart greeter and live in an apartment for 6 months. And I was just thinking, we got the host of the Bigger Pockets podcast on, and I'm going to say, David, where are you at in this journey? And enter any future plans on starting from the ground floor again, going into security or lower level law enforcement? You need a reset, or you blowing up right now?
No, I think life has a way, especially in the world we're in. We ride waves, waves that go up, waves that go down, right? So the entrepreneurial journey works that way. The real estate market can work that way. Last 8 years, we were all on a crazy wave where poor operators were able to pull things off. And the more buoys that you put in the water and the better markets, the better that you did. A lot of that came to a screeching halt by something as simple as rates going up. The COVID situation obviously threw a wrench in the way things are working. And you have to understand that when you get out of your W-2, which is everyone's goal, they all hate their W-2. There's influencers everywhere that are telling people, quit your W-2, only suckers work for someone else. They jump into doing it for themselves. You do get rid of that ceiling that holds you back, but you also lose that floor that keeps you safe. And so for me personally, when interest rates went up, it screwed up a lot of things, right? The David Green team was selling 40, 50 houses a month. That dropped down to like 15 to 20. That's not even enough to pay the expenses that business needs to operate. And then the mortgage company, the one brokerage, same thing happened. Everyone just stopped buying homes. We've got all these employees. We've got all these expenses. We've got all this marketing stuff. And then boom, no one's getting loans. And that happened at the same time that I actually had someone they successfully did steal the title to 25 of my properties. It was a huge mess. Ooh. Took about a year to get that back. And then I sold the whole thing to a hedge fund, bought a bunch more real estate. Right after I closed on it, the next month is when the rates jumped. People stopped traveling to the short-term rentals. I ended up with 6 properties worth a total of $10 million out of that big 1031 that I did, where neighbors were viciously angry about short-term rentals and have been consistently calling the city and doing every single thing they can to stop my construction permits from being issued. And I'm not exaggerating. There's some that are literally calling the police when my contractor shows up. It's like a neighborhood watch that is looking at this short-term rental like an antigen, and there are all the little white blood cells that just swarm on it. And it's been a very, 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 very difficult time in my business journey where everything I touched was turning to gold, and just seemingly in a moment, it's now an uphill battle, and I'm struggling to try to just get through.
It's the post-COVID reflex. So basically what was going on is all these deals were getting done. All these people were engaged, and there was some shitheads out there too. And it's, some of that's working through at this point. And I think people are getting whipped a little bit with it.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. And it just hit me at every single level of all the stuff that I was doing. So I'm not quite a Walmart greeter status level yet, but I do recognize, sometimes life humbles you. Sometimes God allows you to go through difficult times. I'm not above being a Walmart greeter. This is one of the reasons that my financial strategy was always to live a modest lifestyle. I still drive a 2016 Camry. I still live in the same house that I did when I was a police officer. I never, ever, ever let my, sorry, one sec. I never let my standard of living increase to a point where I was driving around in Lamborghinis and flying private and all this stuff that would cause problems. So there's not as much stress on me as there normally would
be. So you held the
me.
Line. You didn't go big boat like Bilzerian. Exactly. You kept it modest. And, you know, that's where the scar on my forehead's from, all right? I got to get out trees. There and I got to get out there and cut my own trees, bro, because it makes me feel like a man. All right, David gets it. That's what's going on here.
That's it. You got to take that blue collar approach, even when you're having financial success.
Blue collar work ethic. It's one of our core value issues. One of our isms, if you will.
David, what have you learned? What are the learning lessons over the last 6 months that you've been able to extract? Because there's always problems, but from the problems, we can yield some opportunities. And what have you learned over the last 6 months?
It's a very good question. So I'd say the biggest lesson that I've learned, it was two parts. The things that you know about already are rarely the things that sink you. It's the things you didn't see coming. And oddly enough, though you need people to succeed in business, people can also cause you to fail in business. And that part isn't talked about because it's not fun. Simon Sinek doesn't want to get up there and say, you have to give millennials a purpose. You have to give them a vision to work for. He's not going to tell you, well, sometimes they'll
That's
just
pretty
take
good,
a paycheck.
By the way.
Thank you. He's not going to tell you that they're just going to take your paycheck and take everything that they can from you. And when you're not looking, not do their job. That is a real part of owning a business. So
that's not his narrative either. Yeah,
no, not at all. When you look at the total reason why I think I ended up in this mess, I took some advice from people around me that I shouldn't have, just trusted their word without vetting the person's perspective quite enough, which led to some decisions that weren't great. I did not closely enough watch the people that were responsible for getting these projects off the ground. When they ran into some hurdles, they just gave up on it and were like, oh, I don't know what to do. And they just didn't do anything. And the stuff I couldn't control is what got me in trouble. So buying too many properties at one time, they would have been fine. My analysis of the properties were great. They've appreciated from the point that I bought them. I bought them under market value. They would be doing wonderful if I could get the damn city to issue the permits to get the things moving on. But it's those uncontrollables that have got me in trouble. So what I've learned from the whole thing, to sum that up, is not to take moves that big in a space that you're somewhat new getting into. I hadn't bought that much real estate at one time for the last 8 years. The cities were not getting involved. Short-term rentals were not a thing, much less a problem that everybody had rallied against to try to stop.
I can sum it up from what I'm seeing, because I think we avoided this mistake, the shiny object syndrome. I think when you outgrow your infrastructure a little bit and you're just trying to add on too many properties, we're vertically integrated. So we have 1,600 units, but it's taken us 8 years to accumulate it. And everyone's like, oh, why don't you get the 5,000 doors? We're not focused on the doors. We're focused on the profit that each door it really provides us. And we're looking to, you know, buy 300 to 500 units a year. That's all that we can acquire. We could have gotten caught up in the last couple of years and bought stabilized deals on bridge debt, like a lot of people are doing. And now you're like, oh, I bought it at 3.5. Debt's now 9. That's a big thing. So I think, you know, you're out there looking at Instagram and looking at everybody closing deals and you're like, I'm missing out. What am I doing wrong? And I think Jake and I were checking each other going, well, what are we doing wrong? I don't know. I don't think we're doing anything wrong. There's just not great deals out here. So just let's be patient and let's wait. And I think we were fortunate. We read the book Small Giants by Bob Burlingham, which is a really phenomenal book. And it just gave us clarity on what we tried to accomplish and what our goals are. And I think everyone really should read that book and say, hey, do I need to be the next Facebook, or how much is too much, or what is my goal in life? What is my vision in life? And I think Jake and I were fortunate enough that we're partners and we can actually share that amongst each other and not be on an island and say, you know, Jake, what do we do here? Should we buy this? Should we not buy that? What do we do in the next 3 to 5 years, and be on the same page and like work together? I think that's what saved us, David. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
No, I think that the danger is when you're looking at other people's Instagrams, what they show is just closed on my next 64 unit, just closed on my next deal. They're always telling you what they just acquired. But that, and it's assumed it's a victory when you get the deal. Okay. It's not always the case. Sometimes you just bought a big problem. Sometimes you just tied yourself to an anchor that you're not going to be able to turn around. And that's particularly true in any property that's valued by its income streams, like commercial real estate of any sort. Because the interest rate plays such a significant role in the desirability for the property, which the cap rate reflects. So for instance, just to put this into plain terms, people that bought properties at 3.25% rates that now have to refinance into 8% or 9% rates, that is going to be significantly less desirable to the next person who wants to buy it, which means the cap rate is going to be much higher in order to entice someone to get it, which means the value of that property is going to go down a lot. And in residential real estate, you don't really have to worry about the value of the property because it's on a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. As long as the tenant's paying their rent, who the hell cares what it's doing? That only matters when you go to refinance or sell. But in commercial real estate, you've got this dance of musical chairs that you're always on a balloon payment, and you have to constantly be thinking about when you're going to have to refinance or sell that property, which means the loan to value is significantly more important, right? Like these things that don't fall into residential space, I don't really care what my loan to value is. I care what my cash flow is. It only matters if I'm going to sell it. Well, you may have a property that you can max out leverage on that thing and it will still work because interest rates are 3.5 and it's pouring out cash flow. And it looks like a great decision until 4 years go by, rates have tripled from where they were and you're stuck with nowhere to go because you leveraged it. It becomes a trickier thing. And I think in your guys' space, you're probably seeing the reason you haven't had any opportunities the last couple of years is there's too much demand. There are too many people playing in that space, deploying large amounts of capital that are willing to take a smaller return. Well, now a lot of those people are going to be getting exposed.
It's dropped by like 75% too. Like the amount of the bids coming in on these on market deals has dropped dramatically. You know, people use the term pencils down. That's a thing that, you know, you hear a lot. And again, I always refer back to raising children. If you have a kid that's a delinquent juvenile that's, you know, constantly doing drugs, getting called in the principal's office, that one kid's going to be soul sucking for you, and it's going to be a miserable time. Where if you raise good kids, where you put time into them, they're actually going to be enjoyable. It's the same thing with these deals. If you don't pour into these deals, you don't do the right thing by them, spend the appropriate amount of time with them, they'll become the juvenile kid that ruins your life. So I think that putting the time in, managing them, whether it's third party and you're the asset manager, you're spending time with the PM, making sure the thing's getting executed, you need to spend time with them. It's not just about ringing the bell, to David's point. Hey, I got a deal. It's going to be great forever. If you put the time in to do the work, there's a big if there, and so many people miss that.
You know what's funny about that too, Jake? You don't hear any podcasts or Instagram videos or anything that shows the grind of the operation. You don't hear people saying, I've owned this property for 5 years. Here's what I'm doing today to make operations go smoother. You only see the picture when the child is born, the kid's adopted. Yay, we got a kid. You don't see what it's like when they're 6 years old and they won't sleep in their own bed and they're coming into your room, or as soon as you turn your back, you know, they're on the YouTube seeing stuff you don't want them to see, or they're making friends they shouldn't have. That's the real grind of raising the kids, is what you're doing actually in the raising of. And real estate is a very similar process, but we don't talk about that. And everyone just assumes accumulating the door is the victory.
So it's here's the key to it. Gino and I both homeschool kids. Thank you, Gino. Hats off to you. I got that from you. And we manage in-house. All right? You take control of it and you get the bad kids out of your life. All right? That's what it's about.
Well, it's a little bit more than that. But, you know, if you guys want to check out David, go to his Instagram page. His Instagram page is awesome. David Green, also a Bigger Pockets podcast host. Amazing show. But he's also the anti-cash flow David Green. Let's discuss that a little bit, brother. I mean, like, you're getting bashed.
He's getting branded out there, huh? Shit. Watch out for his keyboard warriors.
I mean, that's, I mean, it's somewhat funny, and it's also kind of scary that when you make a statement that I believe is very true, you don't build significant wealth through cash flows, particularly in residential real estate, because I'll give a caveat. With multifamily, with commercial real estate, the value of the property is directly tied to the cash flow. Okay, so increasing cash flow does also then increase equity, because if you improve your NOI, you're going to improve the value. With residential real estate, they are divided. We value residential real estate in such a stupid way in America. It's like, how much is that house worth? I don't know.
What's somebody else pay for it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the Joneses paid $600,000 for theirs. All right. Well, then I'll pay $600,000 for this, but I'm not paying a penny more. Well, what do the Joneses know about real estate? The hell do they know? They know nothing about it, right? And they only paid it because the Smiths paid
$590
for theirs.
Tammy Jones is an interior decorator. Look at this new carpet she just put in. Doesn't it look lovely on the Instagram? Man, we're bashing the gram today.
Yes. The comparable sales approach makes no logical sense from an investment perspective, yet we've adopted it, and this is the way it works. So you have to play that game. What that means is how a property performs from a financial perspective is independent of what it's going to be valued at when you go to sell it. So it makes something like, you know, spending $10,000 to improve your kitchen countertops can sometimes add $60,000 of equity to a property that was outdated. But cash flow, particularly with residential real estate, doesn't make anyone rich. I mean, we sell it like at $300 a month of cash flow, $200 a month of cash flow. And when you have 10 houses, which is a huge thing to have to manage, 10 different tenants, a portfolio of 10 properties, and all the issues that come up, you now have $2,000 to $3,000 a month of cash flow. In a year, you're going to be making $24,000 to $36,000. I mean, if we live to be 900 years old, like Methuselah in the Bible, that strategy could eventually lead to wealth. But we will die long before that turns into anything meaningful. what you find when you actually look at people that invest in real estate is they make their money through the equity of the property. It goes up in value faster than the rate of inflation, and the mortgage gets paid off. And over a significant period of time, especially when you combine it with leverage, you can make a lot of money through equity. And then my opinion is you take that equity and you convert it into cash flow. So you take those 10 rentals that are making you 36 grand a year total, but the total value of the portfolio has gone up by $2 million since you bought it. You sell it, you 1031 into multifamily real estate, which was intended to cash flow. That's the purpose that it was created. And your cash flow skyrockets from the $2 million of equity that you put into buying a $10 million building or something like that. But yet we're not telling anyone that this is how it works. We're continually to sell people on the fact that that duplex is going to change your life. And it just doesn't work out like that in real life. And so by warning people, you're going to be spending 20 years and you're going to end up making maybe $35,000 a year from cash flow. You are not going to be able to quit your job and feed your family off of this. I now get labeled as the heretic that's running around telling everybody that cash flow doesn't matter and you shouldn't go for real estate with cash flow. But as you guys see in today's market, what residential real estate is cash flowing?
If you're buying for appreciation, because what you're going to do, and that's going to be the real cash out play, then look for markets that are going to appreciate.
Yes.
So, David, yeah. what I would say is cash flow will get you out of your job. Equity will keep you out of your job. And I think people don't understand that. You buy a house for 100 grand, you make $300 a month in cash flow, you make 6 grand at the end of 2 years. At the end of 2 years, a house is worth 140,000. You just made 40,000 in equity in 2 years, but you made 6 grand in cash flow. That's what David's saying. There's so much more on the equity play. Now, what you need to do is we call it the conveyor belt method. You put that deal on an imaginary conveyor belt and you want that equity to matriculate. As that equity matriculates, especially since you're young, you pull that equity out and you repurpose those little baby money soldiers, right, Senziano? Those little baby money soldiers go into another deal and you want those baby money soldiers to matriculate, to continue to grow. And that's what we're talking about. And then, you know, David's just pitching multifamily on here. Why is anyone investing in single family? Just go to multifamily. Go to Jake and Gino. We'll teach you how to do it. But in all honesty, it's so much easier to buy a 20-unit apartment complex than it is to buy 20 single family homes. I think people are just have those limiting beliefs saying they can't do it. How do you do it? There's no way for you to do it. So they get into the single family home space. Then they start scaling up. And then after 7 or 8 homes, they're like, this is not scalable. I can't find a property manager company.
They're good reps. You're learning a lot. And then
I agree 150%. But they're sold a bad bill of goods, and David's explaining what he's told. It's not a business model. It's not a cash flow model. It's not income over expenses. There's no way to value that because you're just hoping that the market goes up, and now the market turns around, and all of a sudden interest rates go up. You made a pretty good investment, but now the market is dictating. We have more control because if we're controlling NOI, which is David's talking about. We're controlling income and expenses. We're able to push that up, and we're able to force that appreciation on our assets as opposed to the single family space. So,
yeah. If you're going to do that, do it young, right? Do it when you're like 19, where you can take those gut punches with 10 houses across the city, right? And then get out of it.
Yes.
I have a book coming out in October, and it's called Pillars of Wealth, and it focuses on a 3-prong approach to actually building wealth. It's sort of the antidote to the whole, take my course, you don't need any money, I'll teach you how to buy real estate for no money down, and you end up spending 7 years searching, cold calling people, trying to find one old lady who doesn't know what her house is worth and buying it on subject to financing because you didn't want to just get a job and make money and not be a loser. The 3 prongs, in my opinion, of what you should do to build wealth are offense, defense, and investing. Offense is actually the skill of learning how to make money, starting a business, being an entrepreneur, bringing value to the market, solving problems, not showing up like you're entitled to do something, but saying, hey, I'm going to come to work every day and be the best employee at my job. My boss has things, I'm going to serve them before I believe that I should be served. The second function is defense. You, like I said earlier, it's living on a budget. There's actually a skill to being able to keep your standard of living reasonable as your income grows, and you need to focus on it. It doesn't just happen. It's an intentional effort you have to make. And then third is investing the difference, right? When you're making good money and you're saving all that money, you feel comfortable taking the risks that are involved in investing and kind of taking your lumps with the approach. And in that book, I talk about several different wealth building cycles that people can capitalize that will accelerate safely the process of building wealth. And one of them is what I call a make, amplify, invest. So rather than just save money, put in the stock market, save money, invest it somewhere. I talk about saving money, putting it in something that will amplify it. So that could be flipping a house, giving out a hard money loan, or buying residential real estate in markets that appreciate. And then taking those gains and investing them into a better long-term strategy. So I think for people that are pretty good at residential real estate, I wouldn't say stop doing it. I would say, like I don't remember which one of you said it. It doesn't scale. You can't have 50 of these houses. I've gotten to the point where I have 50 of them, and I hated my life. It was like having 50 cats. You don't want to end up in that situation. But they had a lot of equity. It makes sense to sell those and invest those into one asset that can be scaled and managed. So take all the different ways that real estate works, kind of create a formula like a team, like a sports team, an NBA team, where you have certain players with different skills that mesh with each other, put them all together. But your end result definitely wants to be something that's valued based on its income streams, like the commercial properties.
Jake, talk about
Hold on, Gina, 1 sec. I want to, he described my exact journey right there. I worked for 7 years out of college. I was very frugal, conservative with my money, saved up money from my job, and ultimately invested it into our first deal together. That's exactly, it's not that complicated, folks. It really isn't. Be conservative with your funds, learn to save money, work for somebody, get some skills. And I got a ton of skills. I had an MBA paid for while I was there. I learned what good culture was. I learned what bad culture was. There was a lot of learning lessons over those 7 years that I worked for the pharmaceutical company, then eventually hit the exit into multifamily real estate. So it's, guys, it's that, it's not easy, but it's that simple in terms of this is the playbook. Gene, I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, just mention it to David and the listeners. Just, I joked about the baby bunny soldiers. I mean, just lay it out to David and the listeners. It's really that journey.
Yeah, it's
what
all
you
about
do.
Sex. It's all about sex, okay, and reproducing. So, no, it's more like the game of Risk with a lot of sex, okay? Because soldiers are like, they're on the Navy. They get kind of horny, and they got to reproduce. So basically what it is like we look at the game of Risk, and it's that you go and buy that first asset. There's going to be some cash flow with that first asset. You're going to pull your money out on a refi if you operate it correctly. So if you win that first battle and you make good on it, you're over the 1% rule, there's a cash out refi in the future. Those baby money soldiers went over, took over that territory, did their thing. They reproduced some extra capital. Now you're going to deploy that capital into the next one, and you're going to keep that one through a refi. And the game continues to recycle itself, and you're building up your reserves. There's mercenaries going out there to war, buying another deal. They're going to reproduce, and on. So it's very much like the game of Risk. Maybe we get there to some point. We make our own board game. We just rip off the game of Risk, and we call it Baby Money Soldiers. I don't know. We're not there yet, but that's the way we look at it.
You forgot one of the most important things of what the baby money.
Sorry, soldiers I got hung up on sex. You know, I apologize.
I know you're talking about like before. Let's pull it back a second because it really falls into what David's talking about with the three pillars of wealth. A baby money soldier is any dollar that you earn in your life. Now you have the obligation or the duty to spend it any way you see fit. If you use it and buy a luxury or buy a Lambo, you kill that baby money soldier. That baby money soldier cannot be used to go out and to
shot
invest.
Right in the head.
You need some for operating expenses in life? Okay, you have to use those. But the remainder, you can't let them all go out and hunt and chase yield. You need some baby money soldiers back, whether you're using whole life, whether you're putting in a savings account, wherever. You need some of them in reserve. The rest of them, you deploy, you invest them. You don't save money to buy for an event. You save money to buy the asset that'll pay for the event. And that's what you do, deploying baby money soldiers. And then as they start to procreate, like you sell, you're matriculating equity. You sell that those three single family homes. You're pulling baby money soldiers out of those. Some of those you can go and have fun with. Just understand that the luxuries, they'll die. They'll never be able to be used again. Some of them you need to put into another asset. They'll continue to create more. And what you want is you want a snowball of baby money soldiers. And it doesn't take 20 or 30 years. If you start today with in the next 5 years, you can have some serious type of snowball going on. I just don't think people understand. And you were talking about living below your means. Understanding how to deploy those baby money soldiers is really key to create. You don't want to kill them early on. Later on, when you have assets that are producing cash flow, then you can, you know, fool around and use those baby money soldiers for the Lambo or for the jet. But when you're building your wealth and your equity, don't kill them early on, because compounding those baby money soldiers is what leads to true wealth.
Mm-hmm. That's literally in the book Pillars, with specific stories of how that worked out in my life. And I draw very heavily from a book that had a huge impact on me, that might be even where you guys got this imagery from, of the baby well soldiers, called The Richest Man in Babylon.
Dude, that's like one of our favorite books. We love The Richest Man in Babylon. Love that book.
I quote
we did a spinoff, The Richest Man in Multifamily, where we tied it directly to it. Yeah, we did that back in the day. Yeah.
Yeah, so I would recommend anybody listening, check out Richest Man in Babylon. It describes the principles of building wealth, and nothing in there is get rich quick. Nothing in there is go borrow a bunch of money from people who don't know any better to buy assets that you don't understand because you didn't want to pay your lumps. Like, money finds people that practice certain principles, and what you're hearing about today is ways to design your life so that money and wealth is going to sort of be attracted to you.
David, where have you learned a lot of your knowledge? I mean, it's not just watching podcasts and doing videos. Have you invested in your education? Because you're scaling multiple companies, you're hiring, you're going out, creating, implementing systems. Where have you learned to actually grow your business, even real estate?
It's funny that most of the reason that I created companies, the genesis of the idea, was frustration with other people not doing it well. So I was a police officer and I was buying rental properties. My buddies would come talk to me about real estate because they knew that I had it, and I'd refer them to an agent. The agent would suck. And they'd come back to me and say, what am I supposed to do? So I got my license, was like, I'm tired of this. I'll just do it myself. And then I'd have loan officers I'd send business to, and my clients would call me and say, I don't understand what they're saying, and why are my closing costs this high? And I'd have to call the loan officer, figure out what was going on, and say, dude, we can get their rate down. I'll just get a seller credit. We'll apply it to the closing costs. We'll use that to buy down the rate. Boom, you're going to go from a 5.5% to a 5% rate, save X amount of money. Why couldn't you explain that to my client? Why did I have to do it? So I started a mortgage company with bigger pockets. I would hear people being taught, this is how you make money in real estate. And it was almost always predatory. They were painting a picture that was not accurate in what it looks like. Yes, very, very self-serving. Now, if we're being honest, those guys that are selling those courses that own less real estate than me are making probably 5 to 10 times as much money a year as I am. I'm not making nearly as much money as the people who sell education. They crush it with that. But I don't know how you sleep at night, because you're painting a rosy picture of how this thing works that is not what it actually looks like when you try to do it. So I wanted to be on the Bigger Pockets podcast because it gave me a voice to share an opinion with people that is maybe unpopular, they don't want to hear, but is what they need to hear. Like we talked about earlier, cash flow is not as reliable as you think, especially with residential real estate. One broken air conditioner can remove 2 years of cash flow that you thought that you had, and it's not going to make you wealthy. So a lot of the different reasons I started things were literally just my frustration with seeing how things are done in the real estate world and wanting to do it different. When you're there, you inherit responsibility. There's a whole chapter in Pillars about the skill of offense, how to make money, and embracing responsibility is one of the things I learned through experience. When you willingly take on responsibility, boss, I'll do that. Hey, I'll handle that. I will figure out this problem. You don't wait for someone to make you go do something. You look for ways to take on responsibility, which is really, most W-2 workers in our country are playing this subconscious battle with their employers, where the employers want them to take more responsibility and more initiative, and the employee is saying, how do I do as little as possible and make as much money as possible? And we're in this ridiculous power struggle with each other. The few people that go against the current and they say, I'm going to be the one who solves this problem for my boss, I'm going to work really hard, you stand out, the promotions come your way, the opportunity comes your way. And with every level of responsibility that you take on, you gain new skills. Skills translate into more income. They translate into confidence, which translate into more income. So I didn't necessarily learn this from another person. For me, it was trying to solve problems, and the responsibility of being in charge for all these people or all these clients or all these results became the mentor, as it forced me to figure out a system, an approach. I'm very heavy based in like psychological understanding of how human brains think, because that's a big part of sales, whether it's getting over your own fears or helping a client, or for you guys, maybe helping the people that you coach take the next step. All that came from just embracing the responsibility that most people are trying to avoid.
One thing I want to comment on there. So we obviously have experienced the same thing as you. We have over, 70, 80 employees between our companies right now. And the moment that it started to change was probably, to Gino's point, with that Bo Burlingham book. A lot of our team members now invest on our deals, and so they're highly motivated to make sure that those deals are really doing what they're supposed to be doing. And we do that through what we call profit per unit, PPU. We look at profit per unit, or PPU, one of our KPIs, every month at a very deep level, so that the whole team understands that they know where they're trying to get to with that. And then they're sharing in the upside. There's no fees. There's no asset management fees or anything for the team members that invest with us. So we technically we do syndications, but they're simply allowing our team members to be invested in the deals. They're feeless syndicated deals. That's how we run it now. So for the folks out there that may be struggling with team members that are not motivated, or they're trying to find that psychological way to thread the needle, this is one way where, because I wanted to comment on this earlier. There's you mentioned earlier that people go out there and they're like online, they're saying, hey, you should never work for somebody else. It sucks. You work for yourself or you're a loser. Well, the bottom line is there's key differences in personality traits, mm-hmm. and we're all very different humans, and not yeah. everyone is built to take the gut punches that Gino and I have throughout the years to get to the point where we have a $250 million real estate portfolio right now. I'm going to tell you right now, most of the people that work within our organization have contributed at a very high level, but being in a different role would have not succeeded because we all have a specific role where we excel at. So I think that if you're feeling shame because you listen to some jerk off on the internet telling you you're a loser if you're not an entrepreneur, that's bullshit. Find a group where if you want entrepreneurial benefits like ours, you can get them, but participate at a level where maybe you have a safety net because that's, you know, going to make you feel better. I think that's very important. The other thing... Yeah, I didn't know. He's spurring a lot of really good creative thoughts here. I got another thing, too. And I completely agree with you about this self-serving education bullshit. That's why, you know, just full transparency, obviously, Gino and I have a coaching company. But what our forefront is, it's results-based education. And we actually put all of our students, you know, acquisition deals and all that, those numbers front and center. One, because it's good marketing. But two, we want people to understand that it's not for everybody. We turn away a lot of folks that are not financially capable or they're not going to be a good fit. We don't want people ringing out their mm-hmm. credit cards to join us. If you're in a position where you're financially capable to get into a deal, you have business experience, those are the folks that are a good fit because ultimately it's the network. Yes, we have a framework, buy right, manage right, and finance right, but it's more than just the framework and sort of that yellow brick road we put in place. It's the community and the networking that goes on at our multiple boot camps throughout the year. So there's a lot to that. And I completely agree with everything you're saying there, David. Man, sorry for taking up the whole show. I got to stop. Shut up, guys. I'll be like.
I want to ask you, what made you write the book? Because, I mean, writing a book is a labor of love. It takes a long time. People are going to be like, oh, what's you writing a book? Another book out there. What made you want to write that book?
It was the frustration of watching people come to me and say, I have no money, no credit, no job, no skills, no confidence, no life. How do I invest in real estate? And I know the truth is real estate is a great way to increase wealth you've created and expand it and amplify it. It is a very hard way to create wealth out of nothing. In fact, the strategies that are taught to buy real estate with no money, like wholesaling and creative stuff, they're really a full-time job you're taking on. Yeah. Yes. You're working 40 hours a week to find that deal. When the person says, look at me, I made 50 grand off of one deal, they're not telling you that represents 6 months of work or a year of work, that they might have made more money working at a job. Right? So I realized you can't escape the natural order of God's creation by looking to real estate to make up for your crappy life. Like, you have to learn how to be good at something if you want to be good at real estate, just like everything else. And like Jake mentioned his journey, I looked at my journey. Man, there was a time I wanted to buy real estate too, and I just wasn't ready to do it. I didn't have enough confidence. I didn't have skill. I had to learn how to be a waiter. My brain had to sort of be like, transformed into a quick thinking entity that could make decisions very quickly, learn how to be efficient. I talk about that in the book. During my 4 years of working in high end restaurants while I was in college, I actually was able to save $100,000 while I was in school, paid for my school, paid for my car cash, and $100,000 and those dollars in 2005 is probably closer to $200,000 by today's dollars, right? Mm-hmm. With the regular job that everybody else around me just, they had nothing when we left there. I learned skills in that environment that ended up being very useful in business. Then I went on to law enforcement. I had to learn different skills. I had to grow up. I had to learn how to be responsible for things that absolutely helped me when it came time to actually start a business and be an entrepreneur. So the book was just from the frustration of, look, you're asking the wrong question. Stop trying to get into this space as a way of avoiding the route that every man has to walk. Men are not born men. We're born boys, and you become a man through the struggles, the hardships, the challenges that you face. Now, when you have a good father, when you have other men around you, they'll keep you in the battle. They'll actually help you through that process, but you still got to go through the process. And I saw so many people come in at 23 years old that want to use artificial intelligence to replace any form of hard work. And they all want to be social media influencers and they want to land that deal so they can tell everybody else about the deal they landed, but they don't have anything going for them. That I was okay, enough of this. This is the way that every wealthy person I know, they walk this path. They didn't walk the path that the influencers are sharing. And so it's hopefully something that people can read. And if you are a person who's willing to do the real work, you'll do it. It's, I use a lot of fitness analogies. Like, we all know what it takes to be fit. It's not a surprise. No one out here is like shocked that sugar and carbs are bad for you and that exercise is healthy. It's, there's no way around it. You know, one of the examples that I give was in the 90s when I was a kid, they had all these commercials. You guys remember like the ab roller and the thigh master?
Yes.
The little electric shock thing that you put on your stomach and you could watch TV and it would make your abs contract from the shock and like you just wake up with a six pack. There was this idea that like working out was easy. They'd have the lady doing the crunches with a huge smile and it was like, work out from the convenience of your own home and it's easy. And nobody was fit. It was terrible. And then CrossFit started and you started seeing jacked people everywhere, but it was such a ridiculously hard thing that they had to create a cult to get you to even keep going. They were like, look, this is so hard that you're going to need to just be completely immersed, talk about it everywhere you go. Your friends are going to be doing this because you're going to be sucked into this cult that all of you are going to suffer
and
together.
You're going to blow your shoulder out in 6 months.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you're going to track every single thing you eat and every pull-up that you do, regardless of how good it is. But you know, those CrossFit people became insane. Well, that's what it takes to be able to work as hard as they are. But lo and behold, you start seeing fit people walking around. Wealth and fitness follow very similar tracks, okay? Mm-hmm. Like what you put in, how much effort you spend, how wisely you put that effort is a very predictable result you're going to get. But we've turned it into this thing where we make people believe, just like with the ab roller, you can become wealthy and it's not going to be hard if you just find the secret.
Did you put that in your book? Wealth and fitness are very similar things.
Yeah. And there's tons of examples.
I'd like to read that. That sounds great. I love that. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. You're a walking, talking example of that, to be honest with you, Jake, over here looking like, what was the guy that used to do 98 degrees, then married Jessica Simpson for a while? Nick Lachey.
Nick Lachey.
Yeah, how often did you hear that you look like him?
Dude, I got, this is my day right now, man. Dude, I'm blushing. Oh, stop it, mister.
Last question before we go to the short answers, David. And everyone, go check out David Green once again on Instagram. I love the channel. I got a lot of questions from him. There's a lot of great content there. Why do 90% of the people right now not invest in a downturn? I mean, you're talking about psychology, and now's the time. The deals are there. Why are you running away? Why are you running for the exits? You should be running towards the fire, not away from the fire.
Man, I talk about that in Pillars 2. It's crazy how much of this stuff is coming up. It's the safety in numbers delusion that we get into. So there's this belief that if everyone else is doing it, it must be better. But almost every time when everyone else is doing it, it's not good. It's because people don't want to think for themselves. If you look at every single person that became wildly successful, they did not follow the crowd. Elon Musk was not saying, how does everyone else build a car? He said, why the hell do we build it like that? It's inefficient. It doesn't make sense. What if we did it differently? He explodes, right? Steve Jobs was not saying, how does everyone else build a computer? I could go on forever. It's that sheep mentality. So I use this example where people think that there's safety in numbers, like all the gazelles want to cross the river at the same time. So you see a bunch of other gazelles, you go, oh, I should jump in too because the alligator's not going to get me. But what really happens is the more gazelles get in the water, the more alligators hear the noise and the more of them come. And you might have been better off to be the only person crossing the river at a different spot where all the other damn gazelles were in the wrong place drawing the alligators and you found the safe route. So it really comes down to the human condition of laziness that does not want to think for itself, that does not want to reverse engineer. Why does this work? Why does this make sense? And I think whatever you call that is the secret to success in most things. Like multifamily real estate, right? I don't invest a ton in that. I'm in other people's deals and I own some commercial properties, but I don't do it as often. But I did it enough to see that basically it comes down to two levers. There's the lever of cap rate. There's the lever of NOI. There's two ways to increase NOI. You increase your income and you can lower your expenses. There's a skill to doing that. And then cap rate, you have a lot less control over, but understanding the market will give you an advantage. And I talk about that in the book I'm working for After Pillars, just how to know what the government's doing with what they're doing, printing money, how to know if an area has constricted supply, but jobs and wages are increasing in that area and people are moving into it. You can't force cap rate, but you can put yourself in a position by investing in certain markets where it's more likely to compress over time. And understanding those two numbers really simplifies the whole way of getting better at it. I see you guys nodding, which makes me feel good because this is your space. You understand that. If you can really dig into why something works, these things just magically appear. You're like, oh, I could, there's an opportunity. This
will work. It's not rocket science.
But when you follow the sheep, it looks like rocket science. You just don't understand why it works. Mm-hmm. I don't know, they're all doing it, so I should just go and do it too. And then you hope that your investment works out.
Amen.
That's my answer for why I think 90% of people don't make it, where is they're following what everybody else is doing. You saw so many people lose money with NFTs. Remember how popular crypto was, yes, and everyone was investing? Why were they doing it? Because everyone else was doing it. You ask them how it works.
Still don't know what an NFT is.
Most people that bought them didn't know what it was. They just knew that everyone else was buying it, and they saw the results were that it was going up. And when the whole thing popped, it wasn't a surprise to me. But for the people that were investing in there, they looked at it like, oh, I just, you know, I caught a rough break.
Yeah. All right, gang, let's take a quick time out to hear from our sponsor.
Jake and Gino's Multifamily Mastery 6 is coming to the Gaylord Palms in Orlando, Florida this October 14th and 15th. Join Jake and Gino as they welcome special guests like Chris Voss, Luke Wren, David Green, and many more. Discover Jake and Gino's three-step framework for real estate success, enabling students to accumulate $4 billion in assets. MM6 is the multifamily event of 2023 that you do not want to miss. Go to jakeandgino.com/MM6 to reserve your tickets today.
All right, we're back. Quick comment, not necessarily a question. The best financial move that I ever made was moving to Tennessee in 2011 when that didn't seem like a cool thing. And I did not move to Nashville, Tennessee. I moved to Knoxville, Tennessee. And at the time, anyone I spoke to, I said, where's that? Is that Nashville? Is that like a suburb of Nashville? No idea. And to David's point, that ultimately led us to buying multifamily then. And then as more and more people moved to the market, the values went up and up. So it was really a big boon for us. So just wanted to solidify that point. Early on in the show, you said that some of the stuff you got into right now that was challenging is that there were things that you didn't see coming. And I just wanted you to elaborate a little bit more on that, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I didn't see that the neighbors would step in and they could have so much of an impact on my own success by stopping the city.
The pitchfork mafia?
Yeah, exactly right. The pitchfork mafia was just a thing I did not understand. And because I bought so much at one time, that one mistake was amplified by $10 million worth of real estate. I bought a bunch of luxury properties in great markets and great neighborhoods, not understanding that was going to happen. Employees that I had hired that were giving me advice. And then when I got super busy and I'm running all these things, the intel comes in. It's like you put an input in a spreadsheet and you see the result. Well, if the input was bad, the result is going to be bad. And I wasn't verifying some of the information that was coming from me, from people that were trying to impress me, want to look good. And when I got moving really quickly, I didn't take the time to slow down and look at it. That ended up having amplified negative results when you looked at, now I'm locked into this thing. And then there was a couple things, like I didn't see interest rates going up as quickly as they did. I would have been fine had it been on one deal, but I ended up, that 1031 I told you I was forced into when the title for my property was stolen, I ended up buying 18 properties at one time, right? Had I just spaced that out over a period of time, these little mistakes that would have come up, I would have pivoted. Mm-hmm. I would have avoided that mistake happening. It would have been okay. But it's like taking a bite of steak so big, you can't even get your jaws to open and close to try to chew it. I've been choking on it for a while. So it's the things that you already know, you're not going to get hurt by that. And we tend to focus on the things we already know. It's the things you don't know yet that are going to hurt you, which is why when you're moving into a new space, it's better to move slower.
So we talk a lot about having buying criteria, and it's different for everybody. Was the market business friendly that you went into, or was it just the pitchfork mafia that got you in trouble? Was that something that you could have systematized for differently on the front end?
The market was business friendly at the time I bought. Rates went up about 3 weeks after I put them in contract, and then they went up even more about 2 weeks after I closed. So it went from the economy was booming and I bought in areas where everybody was traveling to we're heading into a recession, short-term rentals, people don't want to travel nearly as often. The pitchfork mafia got involved. The cities are literally looking at investors like the evil villain that has to be fought against. So by making the neighbors
market
happy
was
by
then.
Stopping me. That oh, it was. Yeah. And it just, yeah. and it, correct. It was better. Yeah. And then because I'm exposed in real estate, not only did those investments make it an uphill battle, but the money that was rolling in from the commissions and the loans and everything else completely cut off. And now you have employees that are quitting because they're not making enough money to pay their bills, right? Like it's sort of feast or famine in our space. And I'm letting people know about the struggles I'm having because you only hear about feast. Influencers are not going to tell you about the famine. I know guys whose names you know, people who that are listening to this that follow them, that see these guys as idols of investors that are losing money on the deals they buy, but they have so much money coming in from the coaching programs, they're still net positive so much that they're fine. Where the person who's taking those coaching programs, they're not going to be able to weather that storm the same way.
The other thing you mentioned, there was advice that you took, and this may be tied into what you just said, but was there some specific advice that you took that you should not have? I think it's, you know, good stuff to share with the folks so they can, you know,
Yeah, that was just a partner in one of the businesses who's a very smart person, but looking back, I think probably wanted to impress me and was giving me intel on certain property managers, certain locations. There was a person who came to him that wanted to partner with us on a deal, and he was like, gung-ho, let's do it. And then he ended up not having capital, so I stepped in and I did the deal, and then that partner ended up trying to rip me off. Like, I mean, we could go on forever about the number of things that went south. And looking back, it's like, why did I invest with that person? It's because I was trusting that guy's word. Right. And he was not intentionally trying to mislead me. It was this subconscious, like, I really want to prove my value to David. And when I looked back and said, why did I buy that property? Why did I invest so heavy in that area? It was coming. It was information coming to me from the people that he had vetted. And then when I looked deeper into it, I was like, OK, that guy was full
of
it.
Or,
yes, that's exactly
right.
Did
you ever have like gut feelings or hair standing up where you're like, I'm a little nervous about this, but I went forward with it anyways? Was there any internal signs going off, or did you feel pretty comfortable at the time?
No, because all the intel, all the numbers going in those spreadsheets was positive. The other investors I talked to in those markets, their stuff was making money hand over fist.
Yeah.
You know, like, I was buying these deals for way under market value. But when rates jump from 3 to 6.5 over a couple of months and you're buying income producing properties, the value of that property is going to be significantly affected. And I did not see that happening right after I bought them. And I didn't see it happening that rapidly. I mean, we've raised rates so much over a short period of time. You literally have banks collapsing because they bought too many bonds, right? Like, we're mocking Silicon Valley Bank for being so stupid, but they weren't making bad loans to tech companies that defaulted. They ate too much broccoli. They bought too many bonds. Like, the bank should never have to worry about going out of business because they bought bonds, the safest investment that could happen, right? The Fed is sort of tinkering with our economy so much that it just throws chaos into the markets. Like, you guys see in your space how many operators maybe bought an okay deal, not the best thing ever, but that deal worked at 3% interest rates. If they go to 7.5, it's going to tank. And now that's why you hear all this talk in the news about this commercial real estate collapse that's likely happening. If you got dry powder, you're able to jump in. It's experienced operators like you two. This is something great, but how many people were just getting into the space and they walked into that type of environment? That's sort of what caught me.
Dude, nobody has a harder job than the Fed, especially right now, because, and this is a result of the money printing. It's a problem that nobody really wants to acknowledge, because when you print that much money, it was the most challenging labor market probably in the history of the United States, in the amount of people, the great resignation, everything that was going on. It was not sustainable. So on one hand, you had, hey, we're going to cut this party off and there's going to be pain and people are going to lose money and we're going to directly cause that. Or there's going to be runaway inflation to the point that this doesn't even look recognizable. So there's no fucking like soft landing, and we're still in the middle of it. So who knows where this goes? There's going to be pain felt from this. And that's the result of getting hooked on the crack.
Yeah. The problem that I have though is, but the problem that I had with the Fed is they thought it was transitory and they waited too long and they knew better. But this is what this,
dude,
what the
this
problem
is all is. Talking points, Gene. This is marketing. They're going to tell you it's transitory. Was it the Fed saying it was transitory, or was the
president? Fed? It was Powell. But this is the problem. Right. The political system is dysfunctional. So you want Democrats who want interest rates low because that affects employment. So they want really low unemployment. You want Republicans who want interest rates low because it's free money and private equity has really cheap cost of capital. So they're all incentivized to keep it low. So when the interest rates are at 0% for 7 or 8 years, there's a lot of demand for assets. And what happens when banks have money? They lend it to asset buyers. assets go up in value. The Republicans love it. Democrats love full employment, and no one is incentivized to raise rates until it's too late. And then you have a demand problem and a supply problem with products out there. Then they just do it so quickly, and people like David and Jake and Gino get caught in it because we can't see it coming. If they had done it sooner and a little bit slower, we could have all reacted. SVB would have not have bought all those bonds going long, and things would have been a little bit differently. So I know they have a tough job, but they have, for the smartest minds in the world. Yeah, well, the smartest minds in the world, they really crap the bed on this one, brother. Yeah.
The reason for term limits is because you get these guys that come into Congress, they go in with a $200,000 net worth, and they leave with a $200 million net worth. That's the biggest problem right there, because clearly there's incentives there to be in Congress, make that money that they would not have made in the private sector. And while we're there, we'll kind of talk about the people's needs and what we're going to do to make sure that the economy doesn't go off the rails. That to me solves it all, but it's like the fringe, you know, people that talk about this, and it's never going to get done. So we're screwed. Sorry, David, go ahead.
No, it's the point that you can't, you kind of have to think for yourself. When we were printing all this money, quantitative easing during COVID, on the podcast, everyone else was calling for a collapse in real estate. In fact, I was called reckless and irresponsible because I said, no, I think this is a time you should keep buying, because it should have been a collapse. We shut our country down for 9 months and didn't let anyone go to work. All things considered, that should have been ushering us into a new Great Depression. It was a really foolish thing to do, to tell everyone we're shutting down our entire economy until we know what goes on here. But we did it. The only way they masked the consequences for that was to print a ton of money, flood it into the economy. They put us on meth and everybody felt great, not realizing they were on meth. This is now the crash. They're now trying to push interest rates up as quickly as they can possibly get away with to stop the rampant inflation. And it causes different problems. Just like, all right, I'm too hyped up, let me take some heroin.
So get out of the way, folks, and just stop messing with it.
Well, this is quit. Yeah, get out of the way. Stop messing with it. Let things fail, because that's the natural order of how things should go. And if you're listening to this and you're saying, what should I do? Quit trying to quit your damn job and become a full-time investor when you're not good at it yet, because you think that working is for foolish people. It's been that way for the last 10 years because we've been printing insane amounts of money. It's been the best economy anyone could ever have, but that causes inflation. Now you have to actually accept a lower quality of life, a lower standard of living. Things are working against you. It's not the end of the world if you're still going to work, you're putting your boots on. Now's the time to work harder. Outperform your competition. Learn
Dude,
more than
more
other
opportunities
people.
Now to buy real deals that will actually cash flow than 6 months ago. This is the time.
But don't
you
think you probably
in.
Need some money coming in from some source so that yes. if something goes
it's
wrong,
it's not free. You have money to buy it. Like that, yes. I completely acknowledge that. Yeah, I'm just saying, like, if you
that's
have
exactly
the
right.
resources or something to do, you're going to get a better deal. You can reposition over the next 2 or 3 years, and hopefully, I'm not promising this, but hopefully, in 2-3 years, rates will go down. And now you took a deal that you repositioned, and you can put it off onto a better loan. We hope so. We'll see where that goes.
Especially with CRE. Like, there's going to be a lot more. I don't know if residential real estate's going to afford the same opportunities. There's just not enough supply. People aren't putting their houses on the market to sell because they're going to sell their 3% rate. They're going to have to buy it at 7.5%. Yeah, you're going to have a supply shortage and more demand in that space. But commercial real estate, because of the balloon payment financing structure, is always going to have turnaround. And I do agree you're going to have opportunity there. So quit living your life on autopilot, showing up, clocking in, feeling sorry for yourself. Poor me, I have to work. Go to work every day. Like
great
it's
value
the last
for David.
Day of tryouts, and you don't want to get cut.
So David, you're going to be at our event, Multifamily Mastery 6. Gino tells me you have a booth. You're going to be there. You're going to be setting up shop. People, you're going to shake hands and kiss some babies. You're going to be the celebrity in the room, or what?
That's exactly what I'll be doing. Yeah, the one brokerage, my mortgage company, will be there. And then I also run, I don't know what to call it right now. I call it a mastermind because we throw that word around for everything. But it's a group of investors that I teach them, not just how to invest in real estate, though we do have quite a bit of that. Also the other two components, how to make money and how to save money. We have budgeting tools. We have calls every week to go over where people are struggling with saving. I bring in entrepreneurs and real estate investors, kind of like the Bigger Pockets podcast, but you get to talk to them and ask them questions. That's called Spartan League. So I'll have something set up for that too.
That's
so,
awesome.
So the man's going to be there. He's going to be there with the Spartan League, and he's going to be throwing some high fives. We got a DJ Saturday night, so we're going to be doing our oonts and fist.
Are you
going
to be
like,
singing? Are you going to be singing the 98 degrees
hits? Gino's
going to
be singing. Well, I will work on that. He will definitely break some glasses singing opera. I'll probably just be like Macho Man Randy Savage and the Hype Man, but I'll see what I can do. I'll work on Hit Me Baby One More Time or something. That's all I know. Okay? That's the best I can do,
brother.
And real quick before we sign off, David, the hub for all things David Green and the Spartan Society here.
DavidGreen24.com. You could find all the stuff that I got going on there.
Boom shakalaka. Gino with the sexy shirt. Bring us home.
I'm going to wrap it up here by saying David Green goes to college, pays for his college, gets out, becomes a police officer. And he's a police officer. His friends are coming to him going, I don't know how to buy this house. Can you help me buy this house? Because the realtors out there just suck. So he gets his real estate license. And then his friends come over and go, I don't understand these mortgage documents. I'm getting ripped off here. What is the closing code? I don't know what's going on. Well, okay, I got to go out and get my mortgage license too. So he builds two businesses just because he can. And then from there, starts buying real estate, continues to buy real estate, gets on the Bigger Pockets podcast, starts to grow it. And I think the last few years has seen a lot of hard work go into it. And, you know, the market's pivoting, market's changing. And I think David's learned a lot of hard, tough lessons over the last 3 years. And most people would probably, you know, fold their cards, but he's been in it long enough. And I think he sees that from problems, there come opportunities. And there's a lot of opportunities going forward, understanding he's been through the market cycle. He's been through the good parts, the bad parts, the ugly parts. And now it's up to him to say, wow, these are my next steps. I've learned so much. And it's really not about just making money. It's about saving money. It's about the offense, the defense, and the investing, the three pillars of real estate. Can't wait to see that book come out. Check him out on Instagram. Check him out on the Bigger Pockets podcast. And thanks for being on, brother.
Nicely done, Gino. You were taking notes the whole time.
He is the man. Gang, as always, we believe in buying deals for the long term. Think in decades. I'm Jake. He's the G-Daddy. And that's David Green 24/7?
Just 24.
David Green 24. Shit. And that's David Green 24. We'll see you next time. Thanks, everybody.